He awoke in his sleep webbing, with moisture on his cheeks, and the hum of the ship's systems sounding as strange to him as the breathing of some half-awakened beast. 9 standard ship weeks later, Kassad stood before a force court-martial review on Freeholm. He had known when he made his decision on Qum Riyadh that his superiors would have no choice but to crucify or promote him. Force prided itself on preparing itself for all contingencies in the web or the colonial regions, but nothing had properly prepared it for the Battle of South Brescia and its implications for the New Bushido. The New Bushido Code, which governed Colonel Kassad's life, had evolved out of the necessity for the military class to survive. After the obscenities of the late 20th and early 21st centuries on old Earth, when military leaders had committed their nations to strategies wherein entire civilian populations were legitimate targets, while their uniformed executioners sat safe in self-contained bunkers 50 meters under the earth, the repugnance of the surviving civilians was so great that for more than a century the word military was an invitation to a lynching. As the New Bushido evolved, it combined the age-old concepts of honor and individual courage with the need to spare civilians whenever possible. It also saw the wisdom of returning to the pre-Napoleonic concepts of small, non-total wars with defined goals and prescribed excesses. The code demanded a forsaking of nuclear weapons and strategic bombing campaigns in all but the most extreme cases, but more than that, it demanded a return to old Earth medieval concepts of set battles between small professional forces at a mutually agreed upon time in a place where destruction of public and private property would be kept to a minimum. This code worked well for the first 4 centuries of post-Hegira expansion. The fact that essential technologies were essentially frozen in place for 3 of those centuries worked in the hegemony's favor, as its monopoly on the use of farcasters allowed it to apply the modest resources of force at the right place in the required amount of time. Even when separated by the inevitable leap years of time debt, no colonial or independent world could hope to match the power of the hegemony. Incidents such as the political rebellion on Maui Covenant, with its unique guerrilla warfare, or the religious insanity on Qum Riyadh were put down quickly and firmly, and any excesses in the campaigns merely pointed out the importance of returning to the strict code of the New Bushido. But for all of Force's calculations and preparations, no one had adequately planned on the inevitable confrontation with the ousters. The ousters had been the single external threat to the hegemony for the 4 centuries since the forebears of the barbarian hordes had left Sol System in their crude fleet of leaking O'Neill cities, tumbling asteroids, and experimental comet farm clusters. Even after the ousters acquired the Hawking Drive, it remained official hegemony policy to ignore them as long as their swarms stayed in the darkness between the stars, and limited their in-system plunderings to scooping small amounts of hydrogen from gas giants and water ice from uninhabited moons. The early outback skirmishes, such as Bent's World and GHC 2990, were considered aberrations of little interest to the hegemony. Even the pitched battle for Li 3 had been treated as a colonial service problem, and when the Force Task Force arrived 6 local years after the attack, 5 years after the ousters departed, any atrocities were conveniently forgotten in favor of the view that no barbarian raid would repeat itself when the hegemony chose to flex its muscle. In the decades which followed Li 3, Force and ouster space forces skirmished in 100 border areas, but except for the odd marine encounters in airless, weightless places, there were no infantry confrontations. Stories in the world web proliferated. The ousters would never be a threat to Earth-like worlds because of their 3 centuries of adaptation to weightlessness. The ousters had evolved into something more or less than human. The ousters did not have farcaster technology, would never have it, and thus would never be a threat to Force. Then came Brescia. Brescia was one of those smug, independent worlds, pleased with both its convenient access to the web and its 8-month separation from it. Growing rich from the export of diamonds, burr root, and its unequaled coffee, coyly refusing to become a colony world, but still dependent on the hegemony protectorate and common market to meet its soaring economic goals. As with most such worlds, Brescia was proud of its self-defense force, 12 torch ships, a refitted attack carrier which had been decommissioned by Force Space half a century earlier, 20 or more of small, fast orbital patrol vessels, a standing army of 90,000 volunteers, a respectable ocean-going navy, and a store of nuclear weapons stockpiled purely for symbolic purposes. The ouster Hawkingwake had been noticed by hegemony monitoring stations, but was misinterpreted as merely another swarm migration which would pass no closer than half a light year to the Brescian system. Instead, with a single course correction, which was not detected until the swarm was within the Oort cloud radius, the ousters fell on Brescia like some Old Testament plague. A minimum of 7 standard months separated Brescia from any hegemony rescue or response. Brescia's space force was obliterated within the first 20 hours of fighting. The ouster swarm then put more than 3,000 ships into Brescia's cislunar space and began the systematic reduction of all planetary defenses. The world had been settled by no-nonsense Central Europeans in the first wave of the Hegira, and its 2 continents bore the prosaic names of North Brescia and South Brescia. North Brescia held desert, high tundra, and 6 major cities, housing mostly burr root harvesters and petroleum engineers. South Brescia, much more temperate in climate and geography, was the home for most of the world's 400 million people and the huge coffee plantations. As if to demonstrate what war had once been about, the ousters scoured North Brescia. First, with several 100 fallout-free nuclear weapons and tactical plasma bombs, then with death beams, and finally with tailored viruses. Only a handful of the 14 million residents escaped. South Brescia received no bombardment, except for the lancing of specific military targets, airports, and the large harbor at Solno. Force doctrine held that, while a world could be reduced from orbit, actual military invasion of an industrialized planet was an impossibility. The problems with landing logistics, the immense area to be occupied, and the unwieldy size of the invading army were considered to be the ultimate arguments against invasion. The ousters obviously had not read the Force Doctrine books. On the 23rd day of the investiture, more than 2,000 dropships and assault boats fell on South Brescia. What was left of the Brescian Air Force was destroyed in those first hours of the invasion. 2 nuclear devices were actually detonated against ouster staging areas. The first was deflected by energy fields, and the second destroyed a single scout ship which may have been a decoy. Ousters, it turned out, had changed physically in 3 centuries. They did prefer zero-gravity environments. But their mobile infantry's powered exoskeletons served very well, and it was only a matter of days before the black-clad, long-limbed ouster troops were swarming over South Brescia's cities like an infestation of giant spiders. The last organized resistance collapsed on the 19th day of the invasion. Buckminster, the capital, fell the same day. The last fat-line message from Brescia to the hegemony was cut off in mid-transmission, an hour after ouster troops entered the city.